You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. My guest this week is the brilliant Deborah Stratman, an artist and filmmaker whose works move from incisive documentary and ethnography to innovative installation and inspired site-specific projects. Described in brief as an artist interested in landscape and systems, that simple definition belies a rich exploration of the semantic, emotional, sociocultural, and psychological meanings and associations of those two words. Whether it's films following high-wire troops in the Uyghur Autonomous Region of Xinjiang, China, or a site-specific work that leads to the creation of a radio transceiving tower, each project is typified by evidence of two things: a keen intellect interrogating the systems that structure and regulate society, and a rare regard for the human spirit that leads to emotionally affecting work. I caught up with Deborah a couple of months ago when she was in the UK for a series of screenings. We spoke an hour before a presentation of her films at Close Up Cinema in Shoreditch, and I began by asking what it was like moving between film work, the gallery, and specific sites.
Great. I mean, I feel like my ideas often don't find cinema doesn't make the most sense for them, and I actually don't really do very much gallery-based work or exhibition-based work. The work that I do that's quote-unquote non-film is maybe more site-specific, that pulls from place a lot, which my cinema does too, but sometimes I just don't want to make something time-based. Sometimes I want to make something that you can experience either all at once or you can experience more tactilely, so there'll be drawings or there'll be sort of a more architectural intervention, or a radio tower was one of them, or being a sound person. I mean, I would do more of them if I felt like they were easier to fundraise for. I end up making more films a lot of times just because people know me as a filmmaker, so it's easier to fundraise for them. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I'd love to do more of the non-film work.
That was going to be my question. Like, was it what makes you make the distinction between doing non-film work and film work? Is it led by the material as well as sort of economic circumstance too?
It's both. It's more the material, or more how I want to solve a problem. Sometimes I just don't want to do it cinematically. Like when I did the big Swallows exhibition about sinkholes. I mean, the thing that I loved about sinkholes is that they're both a place and an event. So I didn't want to use a time-based thing, which was going to speak more to their eventness than their placeness, or at least through, I wanted to be able to make objects and include time-based stuff. So sometimes it's just what the idea leads me towards. And I felt like, oh, I can do a temporary sinkhole museum, and then I can just have all these different sorts of things. But then the thing that is a drag about that is you don't have, with a film, you of course still have the film, you can keep showing the film, so you can keep showing this artifact about what you did, whereas with the other things, unless you make some kind of publication, it's just, it's so ephemeral. Yeah. At least the stuff I do, because it's not like I make a series of paintings and the paintings still exist. It's more like a temporary structure a lot of times. So.
But I think the projects are, and we talk about a bit about them a bit later on, but the projects are strong enough to almost exist as just a series of sentences describing them.
Are you saying I should just stop making objects altogether?
Yeah, I think you should just publish a book of like possible potential projects.
No, but Flexus, I mean, yeah, they've done it. Didn't Capra do that? Ellen Capra?
I'm sure a lot of people in conceptual arts did anyway. What I mean by that is a lot of the times when you read about a project done by an artist that's happened in the past, what you get is a quite bad description of what the work was supposed to do to you, like its effects, and or else a kind of dry description of what it was. But your work, even in the describing, there's something exhilarating about it. Like I found myself thinking, what a fantastic idea! Like every time I came across something, because I think you have a tendency to really work an idea, you know?
Yeah, I love the research. Yeah. I love digging in.
Tell me about your, because like, That's my own question. Research-based practice.
Yeah.
It's quite a dry term. What, and it, but so because it kind of connotes this sort of quasi-academic, quite dry process. But it seems to me that yours would be anything but that. It feels like you're living with what it is that you're researching. It's a much more exciting and invigorating process. So tell me about your research process.
I mean, I agree that it's not, it can be dry, but definitely part of what gets me excited usually about an idea is just, oh, I want to look into the history of that, or what are the stories behind it, and what are not just the stories behind it, but the mediums behind it. So when I research a theme, it's all the ephemera that was produced and sort of like, well, why is that particular idea, why did it produce a series of paintings, or why were there newspaper stories written about it? Or it's also just, I think, for pleasure, you know, I've always loved reading and kind of digging into things. And for me, that sponge period is, I wouldn't say it's absolutely necessary, but the research sometimes is kind of an idling time for me to kind of accidentally find the right ideas that I want to put in tension with one another. And if I don't give myself that time, I mean, now and then I'll do a project that I have an idea right from the get-go, and it's basically about, I just need to go shoot that. So a film like Hacked Circuit, which I'm showing tonight, or there's a couple coming down the pipe where I feel like I almost have the script in my head and I just need to execute it. That's one thing, but that is pretty uncommon for me. Usually I kind of have to grope around and find the idea. So the research is a way to grope and to come across other people's thinking. And I just love gathering other people's ideas. It's sort of like a gleaner.
Yeah.
It's just nice to sort of find what's been written or produced already and to sort of pull different quotes and put them together.
And I think that's the sort of proper process of research-based practice.
Yeah.
Although sometimes maybe in the teaching or something or in the sort of academic interpretation of it, that joy or that idling time gets lost and it becomes more, there's a text and you explore the text and then you illustrate the text in material or something.
Yeah, mine is not a dry research.
No.
It's a wet, sticky. I don't know. It's some other kind of research process.
So tell me about your film-based process then. Do you have an approach to what cameras that you're going to use when you start on a project? Because you work in 16mm, DV, and I guess high definition digital.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'll choose 16 because it slows me down. And if it's an idea that I feel like, I'm really struggling with, I like to work with a slower pace. But that's not a rule. Like sometimes I will use film for something that's very sketchy and that I make really fast. So Ray's Birds, for instance, which is a portrait piece I'm going to show tonight, that was shot just in 2 hours and then edited really quick. So sometimes I'll choose celluloid for that just because it's what I happen to have with me. And then I guess very generally speaking, I've often chosen video if the travel is kind of too difficult, or I'm the only person, I'm everybody, I'm the crew, I'm the camera, I'm everybody, and so I want something really light and portable. I'll choose digital gear for that. Like the stuff I've been shooting in Ethiopia is digital, and when I went to Xinjiang, that was digital. And the Boulevard was digital, but I can't even remember what. I think just because it was impractical, because we knew we'd have to spend so long getting to know people and on the street shooting, that it made more sense to use a medium that we didn't feel so precious about. But also it's just nice to use a medium you haven't recently used. So like when I went to the Yukon, I brought Super 8, A, because I hadn't shot Super 8 since the 80s, B, because in the winter it's so freaking cold. It's like minus 52 Fahrenheit, which I don't know what that is, Celsius, but everything just freezes. Mm. So the Super 8 was small and I could make a little jacket for it with like heat packs and... And it's everything about being up there was sort of about the history of gold, and it's all alluvial gold up there. It's all gold that sort of accrues in river bottoms, and then they dredge it up.
So are you talking about the optimism?
Yeah, optimism.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So just because what we've already been doing is talking through your practice without describing any of the films. So apologies, listeners. It's because we both know what's happening, but from this point on, we will be doing short sentence descriptions of the film. So I haven't seen Optimism yet, but I know it's a film that's based in around the Yukon, right?
It's in the Yukon. It's sort of northern Canada at the confluence of the Klondike and the Yukon rivers, sort of just east of Alaska, but pretty far north. And that town where we happened to be, actually my partner and I were there because we had a sculpture commission. So we were making sculptural pieces, and then I just brought up the Super 8 because I thought, well, we're going to be all the way up there. I should shoot some material, and maybe it'll eventually become something. And then I sat on it for 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
And then just by chance, I happened to listen to an audio interview I did with the ex-mayor of Dawson, and it was so good and so funny, and I knew, I was like, you know what, I have a film, because this can be part of the soundtrack. Mm. So the reason I brought up Alluvial Gold is because Dawson was, it basically became huge, it ballooned because of the gold rush, and so it became its own town, and so I felt like the fact that the film is so grainy, I was like, oh, that's perfect, because it's Super 8, and everything about how the fortunes were made there and why it boomed and bust was because of the Alluvial Gold.
Wow.
So,
that's amazing how it all came together. So how do you find, though, when you you have those projects where you're like, this is exactly how it is, you do the project almost before you step to the camera. Is there, do you have a difficulty sometimes in stepping to the camera and suddenly the pre-planning doesn't seem to match up with what you're getting? Or is it not really like that?
I mean, it's so rare that I do a lot of pre-planning that it hasn't happened too much that I've had to step away. I mean, with a film like The Illinois Parables that you brought up earlier,
which is
talking on the way here.
Yeah, so we're talking to one, that's a long form film looking at sort of history of Chicago.
Illinois. There was a few sort of enactments and reenactments embedded in that, that maybe some things were surprises, but yes, I mean, I have had things be a big surprise, but for the most part, because I don't do a lot of writing and an excessive amount of pre-planning, I'm basically always ready for a surprise, because I never really know a lot of times what I'm going to be confronted with. I mean, that said, there's definitely been like horrible travesties when I was working on In Order Not to Be Here, which is a sort of an essay film about I guess safety and fear and sort of circles of that. And there's a shot at the end. It's all shot in corporate parks in suburban America. And there's a shot at the end from a helicopter with
a
running
guy.
Shot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And
yeah.
That shot was like a total disaster, because the first time we were shooting it, the guy who was operating the FLIR, which is a gyroscopically mounted camera on the bottom of the helicopter, they had just forgot to press record, so we shot the whole thing,
oh, no.
And it went totally, totally wrong. We had to go reshoot it. So things like that happen where there's a total disaster.
Yeah.
But
it's not.
I knew if I didn't have that shot, then I didn't have a film.
Right.
But I ended up getting it again, you know, a month or so later. So then I had a film.
Brilliant.
Yeah. It does happen, though, I guess, that things go really wrong. But maybe I just, like, willfully forget them all, so I can't think of them right now.
So you made 38 films. I tried to count them. I might have it slightly wrong, but I reckon it's 38 films since 1990 and staged 26 non-film-based projects. So it's difficult for me to figure out, like, where to, start officially talking about our work. We've been talking, like, around work, but, like, which to delve into. But I'd like to start somewhere in the middle with your 2004 film, Kings of the Sky.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was a documentary following the Xinjiang Uyghur, is that?
Uyghur
Autonomous Region Doaz Group, which, so they're like a family of high wire performers. So in one sense, it's a film about the poeticism of performance, but also about the suppression of Muslim populations in Western China. People have quite a dry way of talking about this, to say, oh, I want to know about access. I'm not interested in access. I'm interested in how the film happened, because it seems to me to be an extraordinary work. And I just wondered how you came to be there, how you came to cover the story.
How did I come to be there? So a lot of times projects start for me geographically. Like, I get sort of obsessed with a certain place on the planet for a geographic reason. And in that case, I got obsessed with Xinjiang because it's the most inland place in the world. And I just felt like, oh, that's interesting. Further from the ocean than anywhere else. I mean, I grew up in a pretty landlocked part of America in the Midwest, so I can relate. But I also felt like not only was it the most landlocked, but it's where the Silk Road went through. It's where Europe meets Asia, meets the Middle East. And so, and I knew it was, there was a complicated past there. So I felt that's enough to get me hooked.
How did you find that out?
I don't know. Just like read some random thing and you're like, oh, it's the most inland place in the world. It wasn't like I was wondering, I wonder what the most inland place in the world is, but I must have just come across it and remembered it and then thought, what came next? I don't exactly remember. I think I might have found out about a grant for people who had graduated from certain schools in California that they would fund going to China on a project. And so I was like, I wonder what happens in Xinjiang, that inland place in the world. And so I started reading about different weird traditions there, or unusual traditions. One was like a kind of a polo, but they toss a live sheep. And then at some point in that research, found out that tightrope walking was their national sport, and found out a little bit. I knew a tiny bit, but not much about, you know, how the Muslim population there had a relationship with China that wasn't too unlike the Tibetans. But at that time, Westerners knew a lot less about them, or there was a lot more empathy for sort of Tibetan history and culture than there was for Uyghur. So I felt like, okay, that's enough. Tightrope walking, it's sort of like walking this line between trying to maintain a tradition and it's literally, they're performers, so if I hook up with them, we'll have a language that we can speak that's not speaking, because I don't speak or didn't speak very much Chinese. I knew a little bit, like I volunteered for a while, so I learned a tiny bit, but I didn't speak any Uyghur at the time. But I did have some, you know, like a sub-level panic attack on the plane going over, just kind of like, I don't know, what am I doing? I don't know anybody. So I went over, went to Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang. There was one person who was sort of who taught English at the university, and I don't remember how I got his email. I met with him one of the first days I was there, and then he introduced me to a kind of a fixer journalist guy who seemed to know everybody in town, and that guy introduced me to the manager of the tightrope troupe. So in an incredibly short amount of time, I was introduced to the tightrope troupe, and then it was just almost an accident that they happened to be in Urumqi when I was there and about to leave on tour, because they tour 11 months out of the year. So it was sort of a fluke that they happened to be there when I was there.
And how long were you, because you toured, did you tour with them?
I did. I went on tour with them for about 2 months.
How did that work? If you had no, you could.
It was blind faith a little bit. I had to extend my visa a couple times when I was there. And I mean, basically the manager, I went to meet the manager, who was a spoon bender. There was like a giant portrait of him above, you know, where I went to meet him, of him like looking at a spoon and bending. And he granted me, I don't know, access. And so then I went and met Adil, who was sort of the superstar guy, who I had known of Adil, but I just didn't think, I felt like this whole film could very easily be a project about looking for tightrope walkers. I mean, I honestly had no real sense that I was going to meet them, and that I certainly not that I was going to be invited to go on tour with them. So, but because whatever, I happened to be there at this magic window, and it came up during my first interview, or the first time I went to meet Adil and his family, they just dropped into the conversation, because the journalist was still there at the time, who was sort of serving as a translator, that they were about to leave on tour, and would I want to go with? And I just said yes. Wow. And then there we were off. And at that time, I had no idea what a tour meant. I just thought it would be like a week or something.
Yeah.
And we were on the road almost a month. And I was like, we have to go somewhere to extend my visa. Oh, yeah. How much longer is the tour?
So were you, because what I like about your film, especially the ones where you use the DV camera, you know, longer form documentaries, is that it doesn't feel as if you're an outsider looking in. Not to say that it feels like you're one of the people in the film, but you're part of what's happening. And I like the way, especially, I think it's in two films I've seen, in The Boulevard and in Kings of the Sky, where they turn the camera on you.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel about power, that in that it feels about a relationship, a playful relationship. Mm. So I wondered, what was it like building that relationship? Did you even think about it consciously in terms of building a relationship, or were you just thrown into a situation where you became part of this traveling
troupe? I think it was more through, it was more the latter, but you know, you're conscious when you're an other, you're always conscious of that gap. I mean, you're always conscious on some, you can't not be completely other, especially if you're the only white person. And you know, I mean, that area is closed to Westerners actually, so it was a total fluke that I was there. The only reason I was able to travel there was because Adil is such a superstar that all of the checkpoints would just sort of wave him through just so they could get his autographs. And so that I was there with them. I mean, I've met researchers and ethnomusicologists who are shocked. They're like, how did you get around Xinjiang so easy? So it wasn't something I was so conscious about, oh, I need to make sure I illustrate the gap between me and them. But I think it came more naturally out of just, in that case, living with people for 2 months and you're just kind of with them every day.
Yeah. But there's a really great scene in the film where you film them sleeping. And it's like, on one level, you could say some documentary makers would just finish it there, but then you go to sleep.
Or at so least I was like,
yeah, you lay down.
Oh,
yeah.
So nice. I love how their interiors are so beautiful with all those gorgeous carpets. And that was our nap time. And I was like, well, I'm going to lay down too. So part of it just comes from, yeah, the rhythms of trying to be true to your own rhythm as an artist. You know, I feel like that's part of what makes it not feel like, oh, you're you're the colonial presence, even though you kind of are that. Mm. But I think if you're sort of true to, this is the rhythm of how I see things and how I communicate with people, and part of that communication is visual and oral, then I don't know, I don't think through it that much, though. It's more just sort of, I try to be conversational and I try to be a radical listener.
But you can see that you're comfortable with them, but they're comfortable with you. They feel, and that's the thing, but turning the camera on you, like I say, it just sort of shows you that relationship has developed. It isn't one of distance or like the kind of adversarial.
Yeah.
A lot of the times documentary making in this country anyway has a kind of adversarial approach. Mm. Even if someone's like doing it in an underhand way, they're trying to expose someone,
right,
or they're showing the sort of strange, kitsch, weird life of somebody. And but yours doesn't have that. But at the same time, it also doesn't have the what a weird, wonderful world we live in. You know,
right,
that approach either.
Right. I mean, I try to keep things right conversational. I mean, I think it helps that you, as a woman with a camera, you're less intimidating than man with a camera, or you're seen as sort of less formal or more. It's like, oh, it's just a hobby. So, for better or for worse, I'm not an intimidating person, and I love having conversations with people, and I love, you know, I love radically listening to what people are up to.
What's a radical listener? Because you said that and then I didn't respond to it, but now you said it again, so.
It just means ceding space for other people to have the agency that's native to them. You know, people just have so much to teach us, and I feel like, God, it's gotta be one of the most political things you can do, is just to know how to listen to other people, even if you totally disagree with them. And I think that's something I've always cared about. Mm. And maybe then people have stuff to say. So if you come there and it seems clear that you want to hear what they have to say, and by say I don't mean literally maybe speaking, but just whatever it is they have to show you or that they have to teach you, most people are happy to have an opportunity for that platform.
And I noticed that in the film you made in Malawi, called Kienda and Kumbina. I'm not going to be able to pronounce it properly.
Kienda and Kumbina, yeah. It's sort of a failed film, but did you watch that?
Yeah.
You might be one of the only people who've seen that film.
It's an amazing film. That's
Thank
it.
You.
That's
wow.
part of your trilogy.
I almost never show it.
Really?
I almost
you
never
show it.
I just feel like it's such a sketchy, like, bleh.
It doesn't feel like that. But I've called them your DV trilogy. Your DV trilogy, The Boulevard.
That's awesome.
Kings of the Sky and let's say just
Queen
Walking
of, yeah, you can say Walking in
Dancing. Yeah, yeah. But they don't feel sketchy to me. They actually feel, they show quite a lot of possibility, I think, for documentary filmmaking. Mm. And let's just go back to Kings of the Sky quickly, though. What you do, I think that's really, really powerful in the film, is that the politics isn't sort of front-loaded. And when I watched it, I thought, yeah. But I hadn't, you know, that seems like a really important thing and I haven't seen enough of that. So there's one way you could have done the film. You could have said, in the Uyghur region, so-and-so is happening. The Muslim population is being forced to assimilate and it's causing conflict. I went in to see, I mean, you didn't have to say it, but it could have been indicated, but that's not what happens.
I hate projects that define people in terms of oppression.
Yeah.
It's like, define people in terms of ways that they live their lives. I mean, oppression might be part of it, but if you start with oppression, then suddenly there's this power dynamic right from the beginning that's so frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. So did you know that's how you wanted to handle that? Because basically at the end, through the film, Kings of the Sky, we follow Adil and the family and the group performing, going from town to town, taking it up, taking the wire up, taking it down. Yeah. Someone falls.
Yeah.
And then right at the end of the film, we get to see some of the sort of political context that's happening as the group is travelling around. And then there's a final kind of like statement or like monologue at the end over a shot of a track.
Yeah.
At night.
Yeah.
Which explains this political context, which I found kind of devastating, actually, because you've grown with everybody. You know, through the whole film, you feel as if you're part of the group, and then you're like,
shit.
Yeah. So did you hear? That's a very pattern I've seen, and I haven't seen that before, actually. Done in such a way that's so impactful, and I think I've seen it in other works that you've done that since. So did you... were you like, no, this has to be the way it's done? Or did you discover it in the making?
I discovered it in the making. I mean, I felt the burden of, at the time when I made it, because it was pre-Guantanamo and people didn't know who the hell Uyghurs were. They'd never heard of them. And so I felt like, how this is intense to kind of have this responsibility to show a culture that none of my friends know and people have never heard of them. So I felt like that was important to me, to like, how do I show something about these people's lives, or at least what I connect to about them, about the artists, the performing artists, but also just about like, what's the market like? What's the day to day like? But then to leave out, I mean, the thing is, Uyghurs, like a lot of cultures in the world, they're like very restrained about their politics, because if they're outspoken about it, you know, people are getting, especially now, my God, there's like, you know, so many detention camps. So it's very discreet the way they're political. Like they'll set their clock to local time instead of Beijing time, or they'll speak in metaphor, or they'll find ways to be discreet about it. So I also didn't want to... I mean, people were willing to talk to me about political stuff, but they didn't want to be on camera saying it.
Yeah.
So I also felt like, well, I don't want the performers to feel like I'm jeopardizing their family or their kids or something. So that's why I talked to the guy who already immigrated to Canada and his family was already there. But I didn't know that going in. I knew I didn't want to leave out the politics, but I didn't want to lead with the politics either. Like I felt like I want the politics to breathe and for the problems not to be just glossed over, but then I don't want the problems to just be this hammering home. I mean, there's nothing worse than, I don't know, a pedantic political documentary that has this point of view. I hate films that have a point of view. I feel like I'm into something that gives you really specific knowledge and cited knowledge, but there's not one explanation for it, that's more fractured, you know?
But the film made me want to find out more, and I feel like that's, it compelled me to action in a way that other films that tried to compel me to action just compelled me to depression. You know, like, if you just they just show you disaster, human atrocity, but then they leave out
like what a lunch is, an amazing lunch with like
or so they leave out life, they leave out just the joy of life and people living, but then they also leave out what you can do about the situation. And I think people have a duty if they make that sort of hardcore political, you know, where it starts with atrocity, ends with atrocity, and subjection is the content in between. But they have to at least show some sort of form of resistance, because there exists forms of resistance. They're not, and I think, or else the viewer is just left totally disconsolate and also feeling somehow complicit because they're still not doing anything about it. You know,
right.
They've just watched it. But I felt somehow, and maybe it was through the fact that I'd been with people, I'd lived with people. Then at the end, I saw. Then it made me think. Okay.
Oh, it's their situation now. Yeah, then you think about the camps now.
The film continued, you know, in my mind.
I mean, resistance is so creative. I feel like so many peoples have found really incisive and creative and sort of subversive ways to be resistant that, I mean, not like every project I do has, you know, something, sort of a political situation that it's trying to illustrate, but you hope that, right, it's not just delivered to you as like, here's a prescription.
Yeah.
You know, if you fill this, you'll solve that problem.
But then you see with the film as well, this is another illustration of you just totally working an idea, right? Because it's about, you could say, the high wire walking, but then what is high wire walking? It's sort of, but it's suspension, and it's also a flimsy point between death and danger. Which you could say, well, that's the active condition of someone who's living in an oppressive society. You suddenly realise when you're watching the film that there's so much happening, so much going on. Then I also wondered, is that film? Do you come back? So in Kings of the Sky, there's this clip which doesn't seem humanly possible. Is it Adil? Adil is walking across
between
two mountains, and it must be.
Yes.
A height of thousands of feet.
That's literally him.
Did you film that?
I didn't film that. That's journalist. There's two shots from the beginning of the film that I didn't shoot, and they're both sort of in that category where it was a documentary team or just a team, maybe a promotional team that was shooting him at one of these big, Guinness Book of World Record types
insane.
Of events. Yeah.
But it's covered in, so just to picture it, so the sort of, one of the main characters in the film is called Adil, and he walks between, I guess, two mountains, but I can't remember, it's a huge distance, and I think he says it takes him 50 minutes to walk.
I know, I feel like it's a kilometer or something, and just the engineering of setting that up. I mean, I was hoping something like that happened when I was with them, but it didn't, so then... That's sort of problem solving as you go. Mm. You're like, okay, well, I didn't get to shoot that, but let's see if I can find some existing footage of it that shows the enormity of that task, which, like you sort of alluded to before, it's also, if you choose to go that direction, is a great metaphor for just the enormity of this task of how do we hold on to Uyghur language and culture and history and sort of, you know.
But then... Does the work come back again in 2013? Because when I was watching Immortal Suspended, there's a bit at the end where Immortal Suspended is a film where it's like a single tracking shot, I guess, in a kind of storage, museum storage space.
Yeah, it's like the Smithsonian Sackler Freer Gallery.
Yeah, so we track along and then we end up on a Ming Dynasty scroll, which is called Thatched Hut of a Dreaming of an Immortal. And it's someone sort of hovering in the sky. And I thought, that's it. Did you think back to Kings of the Sky when you saw that? Or even maybe not even seeing it in the making of it? Because they're both dealing with suspension, aren't they? They're both dealing.
I think I'm just into levitation in general. Or just, I mean, I think of gravity as sort of the ultimate oppression, right? I mean, sometimes you think about like, what's the oldest oppression? Is it blackness? Is it the damnation of women? Oh no, actually maybe it's gravity. Maybe that's the oldest oppression. And so what are the things that kind of can press back against that? Or is it, you know, is it sort of ways of thinking? Mm. Is it art, an art form? Mm. You know, is it a kind of dance?
So is that how you approach ideas then? Because even there, you're working the concept, you see? Which I like. Because that's why it's thrilling to just read about projects.
I guess, yeah. I mean, it's hard to describe the way you think. Yeah, you're inside the way you think. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, it's hard for me to know.
Yeah, sorry, that's a bit of a weird question.
But I do know, I do have a lot of films with things on fire, and I do have a lot of films with something about, I have a films with shot from something suspended, or somebody else is suspended, or, I mean, I just saw an image online of that scroll painting, and I just felt like, that's genius, there's a guy floating in the painting. I thought that painting was a lot bigger than it was, because I didn't know that scroll paintings... It's a lot of text on either side of the painting.
Right, right.
And that just said online the size of the painting, and it was like 26 feet. So I bought Dolly Guy, and I was like, oh, they're going to unfold it, and it's going to be this amazing big shot. And then they pull out this little box, and I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be a different kind of film.
Yeah, so that must have been a moment where you had one conception of what was going to happen, then another one.
That's true. That was. Then I was bummed, because I was like, I didn't bring good close-up lenses. But then I just decided, okay, it's going to be a miniature. It'll be a 5-minute film instead of a 20-minute film.
Did that happen? How quickly did that take? Was that
for me? I saw the box and I was like, shit, this is not a 26-foot long painting. I realized it as soon as I saw the box. And then when they set it down, I thought, okay, well, it'll just, it still could have the same form. It could still be, you're in the, whatever it is, it's like the storage / preservation room. The overall structure didn't change, because I could still start outside of the narrative world of the painting.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in a quasi observational documentary, maybe like forensic. Is it like a police station or what is it? And as soon as you go into the painting, then it's a narrative, right? Because then it's got a different kind of language it's speaking. And then you leave the narrative again and you're more in observation. So that same structure could happen no matter how big the film was.
But did you know from the start that it was going to be kind of, well, I wanted to say sound led, but that's not right. So, well, the question I want to lead up to is that I heard you speaking before, and I think it was in response to a question about Over the Land. Someone in the audience asked you why you didn't have more footage of people talking to camera and synced interview footage, and you said something about that you didn't necessarily feel sound always had to be synced to image, and that the voice carries a lot of information on its own, and that you could actually free the image to do something else.
Yeah.
And which I think is right.
But
in this film as well, I think it's not just with interviews, it's also the sound that you've used in The Mortal Suspended, because what we see is... The camera tracks across. Is it like a series of what are those,
like,
numbers?
They're like vertical lockers that you pull out. And then there's, I guess, paintings or scrolls or something inside.
And each of them is numbered, and then you've used some sound from a sci-fi movie, right, to count it down.
yeah, it's actually from guys going up an elevator, and they're counting down the floors.
All right, but that seemed to me to be like a good demonstration of a technique that you use, I think, is to have this interplay between, I don't know, what's the film term? Is it diegetic, non-diegetic?
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah. Which means sound like actually taking place in the frame, maybe, and sound not taking place in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
But they allow you to move between the image and the audio, and not to just... I don't know. So the both can do work, you know, they're both free to be. But that film I thought was fantastic because it creates all this dramatic tension in a kind of commonplace tracking shot to a canvas.
Yeah, it gets kind of corny. Sometimes I can get a bit overwrought. But
I like doing it. You put the effects on it.
Yeah. It can get funny. I mean, I think that's the genius of sound, as someone like you knows, if you work with sound, is that you can have so many layers of meaning. We're able as listeners to take in, I think, so many more layers of space and like texture and persona and just an era, like from what idiom people are speaking. Whereas if you tried to do that all visually, what would it be? You know, would it be some crazy superimposition? You wouldn't be able to take that amount of information in. So I think, yeah, I love transposing, taking audio from someplace it shouldn't be, and I love sort of building up, layering up reality, I guess, or what is the space that we're in through audio.
And then I think Hack Circuit, which is the film that you're going to show tonight at Close Up, really pushes it further then, because like it's not just, it's not like a it's not a neat separation. We're moving in and out of separation, in and out of sync, in and out of what is native sound. And so just to explain to listeners, Hack Circuit is a film, a Steadicam shot, single Steadicam shot that moves into a Foley studio, and there's a Foley session taking place, and the film that's being Foley'd is a scene from The Conversation, the end of The Conversation, I think, where Harry, is it where Harry Cole is eventually tears up his apartment?
It's pretty near the end, yeah. Pretty so he's having his episode where he's, he realizes, like, maybe I'm being bugged.
Yeah.
And he is a sort of sonic surveillance expert, for him to have sort of a very meta-paranoid scene.
So, how did that come about? Did you know that they were going to be shooting that film and it was planned in advance? Did you get them to do that film?
I got them to do it. That's
did
staged.
You get them to do that session?
So I got them to do that session.
Yeah.
So the film is it's a total mix of staging and observational document, because both of those guys who are starring in the film, they are a Foley artist and they are a mix engineer, and that's one of the studios they work at. So that is their jobs, but they're also, they're acting a version of themselves, because they would never, well, except for me, there's no reason to redo the sound to Walter Murch's, you know, sound design that he did for that film. So I had the idea initially of, oh, it could be, I just love Foley stages, and I love that everything has double meaning. Like, if this was in there, it would be in there for what it is, and it would be in there because it's a microphone, I guess, but also because of the sound that it makes.
Yeah.
And so the way they collect objects is so fascinating. And I'd taken a few classes to Foley stages, and so I met Greg, who's the main Foley artist. And then I started thinking, it could be cool to choreograph something. So you start outside, you're not in the realm of space being produced or controlled, you just kind of take it at face value, and then you go through, you know, the magic machine where you see behind the scenes, you see behind the curtain, but still when you go back outside, you're still manipulated. You're still manipulated by what the sound is and by what the space is the sound is making you believe in. And that's like, holy shit, that's the secret of sound. That's what's so amazing, that it can still manipulate you, even if your logical mind knows these things are happening and there's 26 tracks of sound and I'm being completely manipulated. So it was a mix of finding them in their native element, but I went to visit more than 20 Foley stages before I found that one, because I needed one that was sort of near the end of the block,
that had two
doors, that, like, so if you go outside, you're not on a giant, like, Warner Brothers lot, that you really are just on the street, and that it was, you know, kind of close to the end of the block. So there was a lot of specifics of what was going to make the circuit work.
You know, it's strange, like, when I was watching it, I watched it a couple of times, and when you go back around, suddenly I thought, is this going to happen again?
Well, you know, it sounds like if you watch it as a looped installation,
But like, I suddenly thought, how many levels? How many levels are in this? Because I assumed it was one, and I thought, am I going to go back? And they actually were foleying what I just watched.
Which is sort of what happened in a way. But that was my own personal post. Yeah, you didn't get to see it. Only in your imagination.
Mm. But again, but the film continues afterwards. And then at the end, then we're pulled into another space, which isn't just about how sound works or perception can be tricked into something, or how powerful audio life is. We're talking about surveillance, and then we come back to that point. And again, it's sort of all the more powerful because it's not, like, at the beginning, front-loaded with this explanation. And it made me think about your work since 9/11. And I wondered about, it does feel to me somehow that this idea of freedom being lost or freedom morphing into something else has featured in your work, and maybe surveillance, or I guess the general climate of civil liberties being eroded in the name of national security.
Yeah, which I feel like, I mean, personally, I've been obsessed with that since pre-9/11.
That's true.
Systems of control and, what we lose in the name of freedom and invisible... You know, how the height of a curb... there's a decision behind that, and there's a control, there's a whole power structure behind a municipal height of a curb, and I love thinking about those sort of the systems behind everything. So I think it's led to my thinking about power and control. And certainly having grown up in the suburbs, I thought about it all the time and sort of had like master planned communities, but then started thinking about master planned psychologies, you know, sort of nationalism and how it goes beyond just how you live and how you move about your town, but it's also how you are open to seeing other people. You know, that's been scripted for you too.
And I think there's a sentence on your bio, because we were just talking previously about how difficult it is to sum things up in a sentence, but this one really did sum up, I thought, your practice in sentence in some ways. It was like that you were interested in landscapes and systems.
Yeah,
and
that's
I was
true.
Like, that's true. I mean, but that's, I mean, that's sort of selling it short, obviously, because there's far more going on than that. But sometimes it can feel like there's a whole world happening in the work. It was great to be able to come out of that and hang it on those two things. It was a real safety net, I think. Because there's so much depth in the work, is what I'm saying. There's so much, which comes from the sort of multi-layered approach to ideas, but also the different ways of registering what we see on screen or what's taking place in a space. Although I haven't seen physically any non-film based work.
Sometime you may have a chance.
I hope so.
I hope so too. I hope I have another chance to make one.
But I wanted to talk about Fear. So Fear was a project you did in 2003.
That's right.
In Chicago. Mm-hmm. And did you grow up in Chicago?
I did. You did? More or less, yeah. I mean, I grew up actually until I was in high school in the western suburbs, which is probably, you know, why I started thinking about the suburbs so much to make In Order Not to Be Here. But then I've lived in Chicago since the late 80s, a long time.
Now, this is an example of a project, I think, that even just in the telling is thrilling. So I think everybody of a certain age who remembers telephones has tried to think of a project that they could do with a telephone that would be, and particularly a public telephone. And tell me, could you just describe this project that you did?
So what I did is I made these business cards that had a toll-free number on one side, and on the other side it just said, the more you desire safety, the more there is to fear, call now. And I put out these cards at public payphone booths, which at the time we still had no shortage of all around Chicago. And then I just started collecting an archive when people would call and they would say their fears. I mean, not exclusively. Of course, there's people who were just like made fun of it, or people who called and
Somebody called for a cab.
There's all kinds of, you know, I have someone working with me right now we're making that an online archive, so it's searchable. So I'm going to be glad when that gets up there, because I stopped it after a decade. I felt like that's enough. Let's define a decade of fear. And I think part of it came out of me, you know, when I think about, like, what am I really afraid of? It has more to do with kind of maybe loneliness or something more existential. And are people really, I feel like it's so much of how media works is just all around triggering fears and getting people to buy into certain whatever products or ideas about who they are, and so much of how stuff is sold to us is fear-based. So I just was like, are people really afraid of the things that we're being sold to? And we're not. I mean, at least this survey seemed to prove around the Midwest and around, it was in a few other places too, out in California, but it was pretty exclusively in the US. So part of it came out of curiosity, just, well, what are people afraid of? And is it the same thing I'm afraid of? And then it became this like wonderful collection of snakes and sharks and people dying or what am I gonna do when I grow up? Or kids afraid of, I'm gonna get AIDS or, I mean, there was a few instances when young people called in who thought it was some kind of social services line. And then that was excruciating because, you know, I don't have a way to track them. I don't have any way to, you know, those were just sort of people who actually did see it as some kind of helpline.
Yeah.
And so those were hard to listen to, but they're still part of, I still saved them all.
Thank you. tone, please describe what you are most afraid of. If you need time to think about what you are most afraid of, hang up, think about it, and call back.
First saved message sent Saturday, September 27th at 6:54 p.m.
Snakes.
End of message.
Mother most afraid of pussy.
End of message.
Spiders.
End of message.
Hello? I'm most afraid of sex. I don't know if a woman has HIV. Hello? Hello? But I don't know if I'm trying to myself, but I'm afraid of sex. And I know you are too.
End of message.
Yeah, I need a cab at the metro station downtown Madison Canal.
End of message.
Angel dust. Animal trank. Animal tranquilizer. Aurora borealis belladonna. Black dust. Black whack. Boat. Butt naked. Fake cannabinol. Cigarod. CJ. Cliffhanger. Columbo. Cosmos. Crazy coke. Crystal. Crystal tea. Cycline. Cyclones. Detroit pink. Devil dust. Dippa. Donk. Drink. Dummy dust. Elephant. Elephant tranquilizer. Embalming fluid. Energizer. Earth flakes. Fresh fry sticks. Fuel, goon dust, gorilla tabs, green leaves, green tea, happy sticks, HCP, heaven and hell, Herms, Hinkley, hog, horse tranquilizer, ill, illies, illy momo, jet fuel, Jim Jones, juice, K-blast, caps, killer, killer weed, KJ, cools, KW, leak, leak Ebola, leaky leak, Lanos, lethal weapons, little ones, live ones, lovelies, love, love boat, mad dog, magic, magic dust, mean green, mint leaf, mint weed, missile base, and monkey dust. Monkey tranquilizer, Niebla, OPP, Octane, Ozone, P-Funk, Parachute, Parsley, PCP, Pig Killer, Pikachu, Pavo, Puffy, Row, Riggedy Raw, Rocket Fuel, Sherm, Sherm Stick, Sherman Helmsless, Pace Balls, Stardust, SDP, Super T-Buzz, Tack, Tick, Tic Tac, Tragic, Magic, Whack, Waters, Wetch, Wicked Stick, Wolf Worm, Yellow Fever, Zombie, Zombie Weed, and Zooms. Here we go. When I was 6 years old, a grown man with no clothes on ran up the street chased by police in front of my house screaming about, where's my fucking bicycle? Give me my fucking bicycle. Where my fucking bicycle? And he ain't have no bicycle. Years later on 10th and P, Northwest D.C., a black girl named Boney jacked up on PCP and meth, starving to death, ate both of her children. 1914, she ate the youngin' first. One time she looked me dead in my eyes on the porch, said, ain't both of y'all sucking on my pussy? And I was alone. Bathtub PCP in the kitchen. John Severe told 25 stories to 50 people not there. Same summer, party at Tim's. Smoke KW, taste like mint. Held on to a pole for 45 minutes in the basement. Footsteps down the house coming out. Anyone in the midst, get out now. What's going on? You seen Tim? He got butt naked, stabbed, dated his friend. Now he's jumping on a bed, busting plaster with his head. He's all fucked up and bleeding, leaving teeth marks in the ceiling. And people are known to kick out cop car cages and windows. Handcuffs busted like they ain't nothing, and Rodney King was dusted. Every bush is a jungle, sweating to death. More paranoid lab monkeys on meth. Every semi-truck on the interstate is the exact same semi-truck, same deja vu, dude. Jive clicking on the highway. One-third conscious, two-thirds out your fucking mind in a fast lane. Doing 10 and a 7 and singing deja vu, do-do-vu-cha-te. And when that happens, you're fucked, because ain't no angels on angel dust.
You're doing a new project in Ethiopia.
Oh, yeah.
And like, tell me about that, because I was just there before Christmas and you mentioned music.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You met that guy, Mulatu Astatke. You know, the guy who does the Ethiopic, he's
oh,
the
Melaku.
Big chef. Yeah, Melaku. Sorry, yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He
yeah.
has the club.
You yeah, mean? We went to the club and he was
oh,
there.
Oh, my God, he's so rad. okay, so this is one of those hard films to sort of say what it's about because I'm still in the process of groping through it, even though I've been talking about it now for like a few years. But again, okay, I had a few kernels that started it. One was geographical, or rather geological, because Ethiopia, the north of Ethiopia specifically, but the whole country is on a triple rift junction. So a triple rift junction is where three continental plates are all spreading apart. So to me, that felt like, oh, that's sort of like feminist. It's like literally birthing new earth. And because of that, it makes the landscape very sci-fi looking in certain places, because it's just geothermal and crazy colors and sulfur. And then it's feminist for another reason, because it's where Dinkanesh is from, who it's like, she's called Lucy in the West, but she's like this ancient hominid, and I'm like, oh, here's your mother's 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 mother. That's really rad. And then I started also getting obsessed with a kind of poetry called Asmari. And Asmari, which you might have heard of when you were at Melaku's club, is a traditional, very old kind of poetry, or Asmaris perform an old kind of poetry called Semenavak, which means wax and gold. So there's a wax surface meaning and a gold political sort of, you know, real meaning. And women have often performed this. So I thought, like, oh, that's so rad. There's so many rad. And I just love pentatonic groove. I love Ethiopian jazz. I love the music so much. So I felt like, well, what are the ways that this poetry, that Semenavak, shows up today? There are still people performing it, but I felt like, well, maybe there's some DJs or some people who are sort of, who women in particular, who make platforms for other women to speak or to resist or to sort of, you know, push back on whatever it may be, patriarchy in general, and it wouldn't have to be through speaking necessarily. It could also be through movement. So right now it's a crazy soup. But I feel like, okay, there's going to be something I'm going to hone in on. And one of the people I've been working with is a radio DJ, DJ Lee. She has a show called Hello Ladies. And so that's how the project got its working title, which is Hello Ladies. I was recently at a pitching, like I was at this event where everybody had a table with their working title set up on a little sheet of paper. And mine just said, Hello Ladies. I'm like, oh, I love it. Look at my table. It's so cute. Thank you.